My dad's favorite athletes were the people on his team that didn't have all the talent, but maximized the talent they had. My dad had a soft place in his heart for that young man that got the most out of their potential. That was my dad's favorite kind of player. And as I was reading through chapter 4 this past week, I started thinking about my dad. Because it's as if the Apostle Paul is giving some really specific advice to the Philippian church on how they can maximize their potential, how they can maximize the talent that they have. And so as we go through Philippians 4, there's going to be a lot coming at you this morning, but all of it is going to be under the umbrella of this is what it takes for us as individuals and as a church to maximize our potential. So I hope you're ready, because we're going to dive right in this morning. In verse 2 of chapter 4, it says, I plead with Euodia and I plead with Syntyche to be of the same mind in the Lord. Yes, and I ask you, my true companion, help these women, since they have contended at my side in the cause of the gospel, along with Clement and the rest of my co-workers whose names are in the book of life. He's writing this letter and he points out two people in the church that apparently can't get along. They're always fighting with each other, apparently, and this has been going on for some time because Paul isn't even in Philippi anymore. He's been gone for some time, and yet he hears all the way in Rome that these two individuals are still arguing, are not able to get along, and he says, I plead with the two of you. Be of the same mind. Other translations will say, agree with one another. And here again, we see that call to unity. Agree with one another. I know you two have your differences. But instead of simply paying attention to those differences, let's try actually agreeing on what's truly important, that is Jesus Christ. Unfortunately, sometimes our disagreements with one another require a little more work than simply agreeing with one another that Jesus is who Jesus said he is, that he is ultimately Lord. Sometimes it takes a little more work than that. Sometimes we have to go to that place of forgiveness and reconciliation. We don't like doing that. A few years ago, I read the following quote to you, and I always appreciate it. It says, I think that when God says we ought to forgive, he intends something like this. I have discovered a better way to deal with your memory of wrongful pain. It is an opportunity to do yourself a world of good. It will also put you in shape to do some good for the clod who hurt you and for a lot of other people besides. I call it forgiving. You really ought to try it. It's called forgiving. You really ought to try it. When we get hurt, there are few of us that our initial inclination is, ooh, how can I go about forgiving and working toward reconciliation? There are a few of us in the room that is our first response to being hurt. For that matter, how do you respond when you are hurt? Those of you that were with us a couple years ago, this will be a review for you. When we get hurt, how do you respond? How do you respond to being hurt? There's usually one of three ways that we respond when we've been hurt. Two ways, we escape or we attack. Those are the most common ways that we respond to being hurt. We escape, we attack. Unfortunately, neither of those are the biblical call to how we are to respond to being hurt. The biblical call is we work it out. Now, when we go escape mode, it usually manifests itself in one of three ways. Denial, the blame game, it's somebody else's fault, or we simply run away from it. When we get hurt, if we go the escape route, this is what we do. Denial, blame somebody else, or run away. Or maybe you're not the escape person when you get hurt. Maybe you're the attack person when you get hurt. In which case, you derogate, which is a very fancy way of saying you hurt people with your words. You say mean things. Or you gossip. which fits right in there with derogate, where you're hurting people with your words. Or you fight. And when it says fight here, it's talking about physically fighting. Some people, that's what they do when they've been hurt. They will go at it with somebody. Escape or attack. Chances are you're feeling a little uncomfortable this morning because you are identifying yourself in one of those two sides of the scale. I know I do. We'll get back to that in a moment. But neither of those are a biblical call to how to respond to when you're hurt. The biblical call goes in that top part of the scale. Overlook, talk, get help. And you might be going, wait a second, overlook, isn't that denial? No, it's different. Proverbs chapter 19, verse 11 says it this way, a person's wisdom yields patience. It is to one's glory to overlook an offense. You ask somebody to get you some milk. They bring you 2% milk. What were they thinking? I don't drink 2% milk. How inconsiderate is that person to bring me 2% milk? I drink 1% milk. They have hurt me. They have wounded me. Really? They brought you some milk. They didn't know you only drink 1%. Is it really worth getting really worked up over that? That's what it means to overlook. It's not worth getting really fired up about it. Overlook it. They meant you no harm. Get help. This is not triangulating. Triangulating is this. It's one of the great pastimes in the church. This guy right here. Daryl has wounded me. So what do? I go talk to Ruth. Ruth, I got to tell you about that guy right over there. When it says to get help, that's not what it's talking about. This is what we usually do. We usually triangulate. Somebody hurts you, so you go talk about them to somebody else. And that's a very unhealthy triangle. When it says here to get help, it's when I realize that there's something that's happened in my relationship with Daryl, and I got to do something about it, but I don't have the tools to do it. I really want to, because I know that God has called me to practice forgiveness and reconciliation. I just don't know how, and I need help. And so if I go to Ruth, and I go, Ruth, I need help. It's not so I can go here and talk about Ruth to somebody else. I go, Ruth, will you help me here? Not so we can double up on Daryl, but because I want to see reconciliation, and I need help. It's a huge moment of humility and courage to say, I need help. This relationship is too important to me to sit on the sideline and not get the help I need to bring it back to health. And when it says talk, this is not confronting someone and basically going, oh, I forgive you. You're not there to forgive them. You're them to use the words, I forgive you, to hurt them. Oh, I forgive you. I want you to know what a horrible person you are. So often we use forgiveness in a very passive-aggressive way. If I come to Daryl, and I'm just picking on you, Daryl, today because you're in the front row, but if I come to Daryl and I say, oh, Daryl, I forgive you, but my heart is because I want you to know how bad you were to me. That's just using a passive-aggressive sledgehammer, and that does not belong in the church. To talk, when it says talk here, it includes confession, my confession. It includes listening, loving correction, forgiveness, reconciliation, and moving forward. When it says talking about it, that's what it's referring to. Interestingly enough, in the Greek language, there are two different words that we translate as forgive. And those words are aphiomai, which means to let go, release, or remit, or charizomai means to bestow favor freely or unconditionally. Agreeing with one another. Being of same mind, practicing unity may require us to practice the type of forgiveness described in those words. I plead with Euodia, I plead with Syntyche to agree with one another in the Lord, to be of the same mind, and that might require us to live into these words. and practice the kind of forgiveness and reconciliation the scriptures call us to. Let me ask you this. When it comes to being hurt, how do you respond? If you've been really honest with yourself, how do you respond? I'm not going to ask you to be really honest with yourself if I'm not willing to be. I'm an escape person. That's my natural instinct when I have been hurt. I will escape. I will ignore it because it'll just go away all by itself. That's how I too often respond. And I've learned that about myself. And so when I feel hurt or wounded, I have to be tremendously intentional about being in the top part of that scale because it does not come naturally to me. Where are you on this? When it comes to practicing forgiveness, where are you on the scale? If you ever think, but that person doesn't deserve my forgiveness, you're right. Just like you don't deserve God's forgiveness, and yet he freely gives it to you and then calls you to do the same with the people in your life. Lewis Smedes, in his book, The Art of Forgiving, which, by the way, in my opinion, best book out there on practicing forgiveness, The Art of Forgiving by Lewis Smedes. But in it, he writes, when we forgive, we walk in stride with the forgiving God. When we forgive, we walk in stride with the forgiving God. We're going to pause for a moment in the sermon. And we're going to spend some time in prayer, in silent prayer. And this is how I encourage you to pray this morning. One of two ways, probably both ways. First way, spend some time in confession. God, I confess that I do not practice forgiveness the way you've called me to practice it. God, I confess that I go to escape, I go to attack long before I ever go to work it out. Own your stuff. So as we go to prayer, take some time in confession. God, I'm sorry. This is how I have tended to respond to being hurt. But then the second part of your prayer could be this. God, who am I supposed to be pursuing reconciliation with? And trust that God's going to reveal to you who it is that you need to be dealing with. So let's just take a minute or so in silent prayer, confessing and asking for his guidance. Amen. If we are to be a church that maximizes our potential, we need to be a church that courageously practices forgiving and reconciliation, because that will be required for us to have unity. But if you keep reading in the chapter, we see some more bits of the game plan for maximizing our potential. Rejoice in the Lord always, in verse 4. Rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again, rejoice. Let your gentleness be evident to all. The Lord is near. Do not be anxious about anything, but in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. I want to pay attention to verse 4, where it says, rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again, rejoice. A word of warning here. You're about ready to get a drink of water from a fire hose, because we're going to unpack a ton of words here. And so hopefully you got your pens out, you're using your bulletins, because we're going to have a huge word study here. We're going to start out with the word rejoice. Shows up at the beginning, shows up at the end of the verse. Rejoice. What does it mean to rejoice? I love the way the New Hope Counseling Center describes this. They say that the Greek word for rejoice means to be full of cheer, calmly happy, well off. I must admit, when I was reading this definition of the Greek word for rejoice, I was like, what do I do with that? To be full of cheer, calmly happy, well off. All right, let's unpack that a little bit then. To be full of cheer, full, abounding, saturated, having within its limits all it can hold. I think we got a pretty good understanding of what it means to be full. Cheer, though. I didn't know what to do with cheer, because I heard cheer as like, ready? Okay. And I don't think that's what it's talking about at all. Cheer is to salute with great shouts of joy, to dispel gloom, sorrow, silence, or apathy, to cause to rejoice, to gladden, to make cheerful, to infuse life, spirit, animation, to incite, to encourage. I find it interesting. In the definition that's before you, that besides actively spreading joy and cheer and expressions of excitement, our role is to also dispel gloom, sorrow, silence, and apathy. It's interesting that this idea of rejoice includes our interaction with the people around us. Are you full of a desire to dispel gloom? Are you full of a desire to infuse life into the people that you come in contact with? Is that what you are full of? Back in February or March, I read to you a text I got from a dear friend of mine. He said, "You are holding a cup of coffee when someone comes along and bumps into you or shakes your arm, making you spill your coffee everywhere. Why did you spill the coffee?" "Well, because someone bumped into me, of course." "Wrong answer. You spilled coffee because there was coffee in your cup. Had there been tea in the cup, you would have spilled tea. Whatever is inside the cup is what will spill out. Therefore, when life comes along and shakes you, which will happen, whatever is inside you will come out. It's easy to fake it until you get rattled. So we have to ask ourselves, what is in my cup? When life gets tough, what spills over? Joy, gratefulness, peace and humility, or anger, bitterness, harsh words and reactions? You choose. What is in your cup? Because that is what is going to spill out on everyone around you. We're to be full of cheer, full of hope and joy, and that should be what's spilling out. To rejoice in part is to spill hope and life onto everyone around us. To rejoice is to be full of cheer. It's also to be calmly happy. And as soon as I read that, as I was studying, I immediately thought to Paul's words in the first chapter of Philippians when he says, "For me, to live is Christ and to die is gain." Here's Paul saying, hey, if I die, I get to be with Jesus. If I live, I get to work with Jesus. So if I live or if I die, Jesus, I win. I don't know if I would have ever described Paul as he's in jail as calmly happy, but there's a confidence that he has in the midst of the difficulties. It's like, I got Jesus. Do I need anything else? Full of cheer, calmly happy, well off. Well off. The New Hope Counseling Center described it this way: no matter what, in the overall scheme of things, as a child of God and a child of the King of Kings, I am well off. My future, my eternity, is secure in Him. I have great cause to rejoice. I have great cause to rejoice. And I thought, I agree and I disagree with this statement. I agree because it's pretty good. I disagree because it's incomplete. My future, my eternity is secure in Him. I agree completely. So is my present. My present and my future and my eternity is secure in Him. And because of that, I have great cause to rejoice. I'm well off. What can anyone do to me? When we rejoice, it's important for us to realize that the definition of rejoice clearly takes the focus off of me and onto God and others. If your focus is on yourself, you're going to be greatly hampered in your desire to be a person that rejoices. When it is on God and the people around you, you are setting yourself up to be a person that can be described as rejoicing. But now that we've taken a look at this, it's important for us to look at the rest of the verse, because that was all just the word rejoice. Because then he says, rejoice in the Lord. He does not say rejoice in your circumstances. He does not say rejoice in your things. He says, rejoice in the Lord. Not your circumstances, not your things. Rejoice in the Lord. The late Howard Hendricks was walking on the seminary campus that he taught on, and he came up to a young seminary student, and he said to that seminary student, how are you doing? To which the seminary student responded, pretty well under the circumstances. To which Hendricks replied, what are you doing under there? Are we slaves to our circumstances or servants of the King of Kings? If you're slaves to your circumstances, you're going to have great difficulty rejoicing. When you recognize that you are living under the lordship of Jesus Christ, you have all the reason you need to rejoice. I rejoice in the Lord, not my stuff, and certainly not my circumstances. Rejoice in the Lord always. Rejoice in the Lord always. Not sometimes, not just when you feel like it, not just when things are going great, always. And by the way, this is not a suggestion, it's a command. Rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again. And boy, does Paul. Not just in this verse, but he says, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say, rejoice. If you read the book of Philippians, and hopefully you have been over this past month, chances are you've got, he says rejoice or joy all the time. Rejoice in the Lord. And again I say, rejoice. And again I say, rejoice. And again I say, rejoice. In all my prayers for all of you, I always pray with joy because of your partnership in the gospel from the first day until now. Where's his focus? It's on what God is doing through the people around him. Christ is preached, and because of this, I rejoice. Again, focusing on Christ and what's happening around him. Then make my joy complete. Here again, he's making a call for unity, and our unity is found as we focus on Jesus. So then, welcome him in the Lord with great joy. This time he's talking about Epaphroditus. He goes, oh, I just look at what he's doing and what God is doing through him and through you as a church, and I am filled to overflowing with great hope and joy. At least 10 times, Paul uses the word joy or rejoice. We are to be a people that are marked by being calmly happy, well off, filled to overflowing with life. Contrast that way of thinking with anxiety, which is what he talks about two verses later. Rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again. Rejoice. Let your gentleness be evident to all. The Lord is near. Do not be anxious about anything. Do not be anxious about anything. Other translations will say, do not be anxious or worry about anything. I told you a moment ago, you're going to get a giant word study this morning. Let's look at the word worry. Do you know where we get the word worry in the English language? It's a combination of an old English word and an old German word. Wurgen and Wurgen. That's the old English, old German. Both of them mean the same thing. Both those words mean to strangle or to choke. To worry is to strangle or to choke. And guess what? When you worry, you're not strangling somebody else. Anyone that's played sports or games with me knows that I am prone to talking a little bit of trash. Just a little bit. Jim's over there laughing. We had a guys event here not too long ago. We were playing cornhole out in the front. And I wish Mitch was in here because Mitch would laugh. Mitch and I were playing against each other. And Mitch tossed and he missed. And I looked at him and just the love of Jesus. And I say, tough to score with both hands wrapped around your neck. Meaning, oh, buddy, you're choking. Don't worry. if I give it, I got to be able to take it. A couple tosses later, I tossed, I missed. Mitch just grinned at me and goes, boy, Mike, tough for you to score with both hands wrapped around your neck. True. It's tough to be effective in a game when you got both hands right here. It's really difficult to live well when you are filled with worry, because when you are filled with worry or anxiety, what you're doing is you're choking yourself. The Greek word for worry is actually a combination of two different Greek words. So merimeo, it comes from merizo, to divide, and nous, mind. The picture of what it is to worry is to have a divided mind. When you are worrying, you have a divided mind. Your mind is not fully fixed on Jesus. It has become divided. Concern and worry are different. Concern is good. You should be concerned. But concern becomes worry when we fail to relate the situation that confronts us to the source of sufficiency in God. If I'm simply concerned, but I don't recognize that God is big, I'm going to slip into worry. If I continue to remember who God is and what God is all about, I can't be concerned and spurred to action. To worry is to assume a responsibility that is not necessarily ours to assume. Failing to recognize that God is bigger than any problem we might have and loves us enough to seek our highest good in the midst of every situation. Do we worry or do we rejoice? Here again, Paul is talking about what it will take to maximize our potential as a church. If we go in the direction of worry, we choke. If we go to the position of rejoicing, we infuse life. Worry is a mind divided that is very destructive. Destructive to yourself and to the people around you. When we take our eyes off of Christ and affix our gaze upon ourselves, we become increasingly prone to worry, and the results are rarely, if ever, healthy. So, what's your choice? Rejoice or worry? Do not be anxious about anything. You'll never reach your potential this way. Instead, rejoice in the Lord always. And again, I say rejoice. Fix your eyes on Jesus. Be filled to overflowing with his love. Let the reality of God in your life spill all over the people you come in contact with, dispelling gloom and sorrow, awakening the apathetic, and infusing life. Here again, we're going to pause in the sermon. I'm going to ask the worship team to come up so we can have a moment to rejoice together before we get to the last piece of advice at the end of the chapter. Let's get to one last piece of advice in the book of Philippians here. He says, yet it was good of you to share in my troubles. Moreover, as you Philippians know, in the early days of your acquaintance with the gospel, when I set out from Macedonia, not one church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving except you only. For even when I was in Thessalonica, you sent me aid more than once when I was in need. Not that I desire your gifts. What I desire is that more be credited to your account. I have received full payment and have more than enough. I am amply supplied. Now that I have received from Epaphroditus the gifts you sent, they are a fragrant offering, an acceptable sacrifice, pleasing to God. The Philippian church practiced generosity. It's obvious in this letter he sends to them thanking them. You have so taken care of me, and you always have. It's important to remember within the cultural context here that the prison system in Rome is different from our prison system today. No three meals a day. In fact, it was not uncommon for no meals to be provided unless there was somebody on the outside taking care of the person that was imprisoned. And so here's Paul in jail, in great need, and who steps up? The Philippians. And not just then, they had always supported him when nobody else was. They practiced generosity and obedience. And it got me wondering, what would have happened if the Philippians had not been a generous people? What would have happened to Paul's ministry? You go, well, God would have taken care of him. You can argue that, but maybe God's plan for taking care of the missionary was the church. And the Philippians stepped up. If the Philippians had not stepped up, we would not have the book of Philippians. We wouldn't have a couple other books of the Bible that he wrote after that. The Philippians responded to need with generosity and obedience, and they had no idea the impact they were having. The impact they had is still being felt 2,000 years later. When we are a people of generosity and obedience, be careful not to underestimate what God will do with that. My dad loved coaching players that got the most out of the talent God gave them. My dad loved coaching people that maximized their potential. Are we as a church maximizing our potential? Are you as a follower of Jesus maximizing your potential? He's given us at least three ways to maximize potential. Practice unity and reconciliation. Fixing our eyes on Jesus and actually being people that go about forgiving one another. More rejoicing, less worrying. Few things will choke out the life of a church than worrying. Few things will infuse more life in a church than rejoicing. Finally, practicing generosity and obedience. So let me ask you this. Which one of these three are you being challenged with this morning? And you might go, all three of them apply, and they certainly all three apply to me. But which one of these three is the one you go, you know what? I need to pay attention to this. For me to be able to maximize my potential and to help this church maximize its potential, I need to give greater attention to which one of these three. What I want you to do right here, right now, circle the one. Circle the one. They go, you know what? This is where I need the most work. I already told you mine. Mine goes in that reconciliation category because my tendency is to simply avoid. And that's just not healthy. All right, so I encourage you all to circle one. It's accountability time. Here we go. Don't worry, you're not alone. How many of you circled, know what I need to work on? Unity and reconciliation. If that's you, shoot up a hand. All right, you're not alone. How many of you said, more rejoicing, less worrying? All right. How many said generosity and obedience? My dad stopped by the house last night and we were talking. And I was talking about this church to him. He was asking me how things are going. And I said, you know what? One of the things that has been a source of great joy for me over the course of this past year was how this church is becoming a church that identifies itself as a church of generosity and obedience. I go, it's been one of my great joys over the course of this past year. And so my mom, I don't know how she does this. She always just sets herself up to be the butt of a joke. She's just one of those people. It's like, oh, Mom. But she goes, so are people in your church giving because of a project? No, Mom, that's unhealthy giving. I go, did you hear what I just said? The church is becoming a church that is giving because we practice generosity and obedience. We tend to be better at the generosity because that controls things. Obedience is where we submit. We're getting better at this. And as a result, we're seeing a huge change in our church because obedience is becoming really important to us as we follow Jesus. I don't give to a thing. I give to the church and let God use that. And I looked at my dad, I'm fully convinced, became bald because of the number of times that he just did this. I go, Mom, no, that's not what excites me about our church. Our excites me about our church is how we're becoming about generosity and obedience. It's a place of great joy for me as I'm watching the transformation. On the back of your bulletins, every Sunday, it says roundtable questions. Roundtable questions. And the questions are always the same. What was one song that resonated with you? Lyrics, music, something, God's Spirit moved. What's one thing from the sermon that challenged or encouraged you? And where did you notice the presence of God? When you leave here today and you gather around a table or you get into your car or you go to lunch, ask those questions. And when it gets to the part of the sermon one, share the thing you circled, because we're better when we go through this together. Would you pray with me, please?